let's stop for a minute and think about some things. I'm Emma Alluri, and welcome to the first episode of What the Hell is Going On? What the hell is going on is a big question. It's a question that we ask more than we even realize. Often we go about our day and everything is fine and dandy and we're not questioning anything and, you know, maybe little things happen. But the more things disrupt our happiness, the more the question arises. And the more intense it is, the more likely it is that the question will become, what the hell is going on? I think it's probably one of the most frequently asked questions on the planet. But what the hell is going on is a big, huge, huge question. It can go into so many different categories. I mean, what the hell is going on with the planet? What the hell is going on with all the prejudice? And what the hell is going on with all the violence towards others? What the hell is going on in our politics? So what will be addressed here will be a bottom line. What we will be talking about is what the hell is going on with us as human beings, what it is that causes us the confusion for the question to even come up, what is our experience of just being a human being, and what are the things that interfere with this one thing that we all desire most, more than anything, which is happiness. As we go along in these episodes, we will go deeper and deeper into this. I first started addressing this question, actually probably at the age of 11 when my mother died. I just didn't realize that that was what I was saying. She had always kind of been the one who explained everything to me, and when she died, she wasn't there to explain things, so I was left with this, what the hell is going on? But more acutely was aware of the question of, why do people go out of their way to hurt others? This opened my eyes to a world that many children don't have their eyes open to at such a young age, and I began to watch and pay attention and wonder why we would do the things that we did, which led me into a field initially of nursing, then into the field of psychology. When I was working in my first psychotherapist job, I actually went into a staff meeting one day and I said, you know, I'm going to write a book called What the Hell is Going On? Because that's the question I hear asked every day. Everybody laughed. They thought it was funny. But there was a part of me that knew that I was serious. I was a new therapist, and as I looked at these things and paid more and more attention, the thing that struck me most was the whole idea that somebody would come in to see me and I would help them deal with whatever issue it was that they had going on. But I felt like they would leave with kind of like a Band-Aid on. And it was like, what about all this other suffering that I see? This kind of human suffering that we all seem to have. I had it, and all the other therapists had it, and all the psychiatrists had it, and everyone I encountered had it. And I would try to have these conversations with people. Most people would say, well, you know, they never thought about it. And even though people were in the field of psychology, they were human beings. And so they all dealt with their suffering in different ways. Some dealt with it with drugs. Some dealt with it with self-development kind of issues. We all dealt with it in our different ways. But for me, I became very frustrated with the field of psychology and then with the New Age movement. I would maybe meet a teacher and I'd ask them, say, I come up to a stop sign and it's my turn to go, and I start to go and somebody pulls out in front of me and I'm really angry. What do I do with that? So most of the time, any teacher would just tell me, well, send them love. And it's like, well, I'm not feeling love. What do I do with this anger? And I never got a satisfactory explanation for that. And I never found anyone that would really have a conversation with me about this basic human suffering that we all seem to have. They certainly didn't teach it in Western psychology. So in my early 30s, I decided to take a year off from working as a therapist and travel. I stayed with an Israeli friend in California for a while, and he taught me how to travel the cheap backpacker way. And then I went to Asia because I'd already been through Europe, and Europe didn't seem that different to me, and I wanted to go someplace different. So as I was traveling through China and Thailand and all these different places, the people I seemed to enjoy the conversations with the most were Buddhists. I would hear about all these different Buddhist things going on. I attended one meditation class in Thailand, which really opened my eyes to my own way of thinking, but wasn't quite a fit. And so when I went to Nepal, I had heard about this place called Kopan Monastery that did a monthly meditation course. every November they do a month-long course on Introduction to Buddhism. So I decided to attend that. And what was so surprising to me when I walked in was that they were talking about this very thing that I had been seeing, this basic human suffering. I first went there in 1988, and I have been watching and gathering, I guess, my personal and views and data and exploring how we think and what's going on ever since that time. And I had actually started before that, but I was very consciously aware of wanting to understand my own suffering and others' suffering and what I could do to help myself and others. So this became my path. I lived in Asia for 8 years before returning to the States. And what's interesting is going in and out of the States, I would see different things. Like I would run into a lot of American bashing, and I would hear Americans are this or Americans are that. And so I would come back to the States over the summer to make some money. And then I would kind of look at what is this that was being said. Like, for example, some German woman said to me, Americans are so superficial. And it's like, well, why do you say that? And she said, because Americans will ask you how you are, and they don't really want to know. I said, I realize you don't think there's any culture in America, but there is. When people say, hi, how are you? It's just a friendly hello. And they really don't expect you to give an answer. If they really want to know how you are, they stop. They take the time. It's just not going by and saying, hi, how are you? But it was very eye-opening to me in many ways about our culture. So in this show, we are not going to be exploring what's wrong with the environment. We're going to be talking about who and what and how we are as human beings and what it is about our human condition that interferes with our happiness. Most importantly, we're going to be talking about a lot of the cultural myths that we have as human beings that interfere with our happiness. For me, I was privileged when I was first starting out in the field of psychology to meet two incredible mentors. I am a white American female, and when I started in the field, I had had some African American friends before, but when I started working in the field of psychology as a nurse at the age of 23, I was fortunate to meet two much older, strong African American women who became my role models, my mentors, and actually my mothers, who helped me with my own growth and understanding of myself and others. I was living in a large city of Indianapolis, Indiana, and after a certain period of time, I traveled on to Asia. So I have been very fortunate in my life to have a lot of experience with diverse cultures. The African American culture I was very much involved in because of my mother's. Living in Asia, I was very involved with the Nepali and even more so the Tibetan cultures. And then I was also in India often. And I worked in India for a short time, running a home for destitute and dying people. So for me, I always found it interesting that people don't like people of color or other color. You know, white's a color, but people of color is said to mainly mean people who are not white. I found that strange because to me, diversity and culture is kind of like other cultures, is the spice of life. So part of what we'll talk about is the whole thinking that we seem to have that of self and others. Like, I am of the white culture and you are of the black culture. This is my group and that is your group, self and others. Whereas in reality, anyone who studies the field of genetics, and genetics will tell you that we are 99.9% the same. And it's only that 0.1% that gives us the color of our hair and the color of our skin. So we are all human beings first. So how is this that we have this development that we think this is a self and that is other? What is it that we separate our white culture from the black culture, and my culture is better than your culture, and you're this, this, and this because you belong to a particular culture? It's interesting when you look at history and the whole idea of the dominance of the world by white populations, mainly beginning with Europe. The Europeans were the ones who went out and took over lands in Africa and in Latin America and Central America and actually America. The only person who is an Aborigine to America is the Native American. The rest of us are all immigrants. Our family immigrated at some point in time, especially if you, well, any culture, whether you're white, black, Arabic, whatever, you know, it doesn't matter because none of us were original people of this country unless you're Native American. It's very sad when you look at the situation that has happened with the Native Americans and how they have been marginalized and just now are actually seeming to have more equal rights in the world. This dominance is an interesting thing. I could go on and on about the world and how it works and what it's about, but that's not really what this podcast is going to be about. This podcast is going to be about looking at us. But we can't explore us without looking at our culture, whether that's the culture within us and our family and the culture of our country. Because when we're born with what I would call our hard drive. We're born with our body and our brain, and this is what actually acts as like the sort of the hard drive of our computer. And then we're taught certain things, and these become like software programs on our hard drive. We're taught how to think and who we are, and some of these software programs are really good, like how to read and how to write and where to go to the bathroom. But some of these software programs are faulty, and we will talk about this faulty software programs because these are what often is what makes this self and others, this separation of groups, and what makes for a certain level of unhappiness. There are two really main cultural faulty programs that we're all taught. These are actually pretty dominant throughout the world. The biggest one that interferes the most with our happiness and actually is sort of like the root to all the difficulties in the world, in my opinion, is this idea that happiness can be found from things outside of ourselves. There's another one that we'll talk more about, which is that we're alone in our human condition, thinking that we're the only ones that experience certain things that are actually really common to human beings. But we'll start by focusing on this one, that happiness is something found from exterior things. If you look at the development of man, it's understandable that way back when, before the Industrial Revolution, and even farther back than that, men and women gathered in villages and in groups in order to be able to sustain themselves. Well, not everybody gathered in a group, but you looked outside of yourself because you were focused mostly on the basic human needs of food, water, and shelter, and safety. So people came together to be sure that these things were happening because these are the bottom line, all the things that we need to live. Maybe in certain places you might not need to have shelter, but even if you're in a warm climate, you need shelter from the sun. It's easy to understand how these things came about. But as we became more industrialized, it's interesting that this whole way of thinking continued. We're all taught all the exterior things of success. You need money and you need friends and you need to be concerned about your reputation, all these exterior things that we need to be happy. It's interesting when you look at somebody who has all of these things, they're not necessarily happy. I think that the current president of the United States is an example of that. He's a person with tremendous wealth. He has a beautiful wife. He seems to have at least somewhat well-behaved and accomplished children from a short exterior view. People would argue about that. He's been a famous person, and he's been successful in his life. So what is it about this person that doesn't seem to really be happy? The only time I see him smile is when he's in a crowd, talking to a crowd, and he's got people stirred up about some kind of issue, usually something negative towards another. But he doesn't in general seem to be a happy person, and he certainly doesn't seem to be a secure person. But this is an example. Other examples are you take Whitney Houston, beautiful, famous, had everything externally you think that someone would need, even had a great daughter. And she fell into heavy drug use, and eventually this is what killed her. Another example is, say, Princess Diana, who seemed to have everything. She's probably the most famous woman in the world. She had beauty, she had money, she had lovely children. She went through a point where she didn't have the partner that she wanted, but everything else that you would think you would need to be happy, she had. Yet she openly shared with us just how unhappy she was. We can go on and on. We all know stories of many famous people who have died from drugs, drug abuse, or overdose. And if this is the answer to happiness, then why would this happen? Again, it's this whole idea of looking outside to external things for happiness. And the big problem with that is that if you are looking to things outside of yourself for happiness, then things go up and down. You've got a new car, man, you're happy. But then somebody scratches your car and then you're not happy anymore. I have a girlfriend who had that situation. So delighted about having her new car and then so depressed when somebody scratched the car. You get married or you start a new relationship and you're so happy, you're so in love. Then the relationship falls apart and you're incredibly unhappy. This is what happens when you are looking outside of yourself for happiness. Things go up and down. So there's not ever going to be any kind of stable happiness because your happiness is dependent. It's dependent on things outside of yourself. And this is a pretty widely believed, what I call, faulty myth that's believed by most everybody in the world. I call it a faulty myth because myths are things that we're taught to believe that aren't necessarily true. And this is definitely, from all the people that have everything, not the answer to a stable happiness. What we will be talking about is the answer to a stable happiness is actually an inner path, but that will be a longer conversation. When we come back for the next session, I will talk about someone called Abraham Maslow. Maslow, many people know, he was a famous psychologist who developed something called Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. And so we'll talk about that because my level of happiness or my obstacles to happiness can be different than someone else's obstacles to happiness. If you are an African American or many people of color in America, you find an obstacle that I, as a white person of privilege, has not found. And that is the prejudice that gets in your way, some of the prejudice that's built into certain systems. The beginning of the African American culture in this country, or the majority of African American cultures who were actually kidnapped from Africa by English slavers and brought here and held in slavery for hundreds of years, something that is difficult for me to comprehend. One thing I will tell you, though, that there is a way to increase your happiness right here, right now, as soon as you listen to this or walk away or wherever you are, whatever you're doing. And that is to show kindness to someone. It's amazing the power of kindness. You heard me talk about the things that I would see when I would come back from Asia to work for a few months in the summer to increase my income so I could go back and live in Asia again, either Nepal or India. One of the things I would notice when I would come back was how angry people were and how much prejudice there was. And I would talk to people, and people would often say, no, that's all been worked through, and I don't know what you're talking about with this anger. And it was really interesting because being part of the culture for so long, it's really hard to see your culture when you're in the middle of it. And I was in a situation of being blessed in 1989 to be at a teaching with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And at the time, we broke for lunch and we went out into the community and heard there had been an uprising of some monks in Tibet and the Chinese had just killed them. The young Tibetans were going, Yeah, we got to fight them. We got to get guns. And I'm going, yeah, you got to get guns. You know, that's all the Chinese understand. You got to get guns or they'll just continue to do it. And then after lunch, we went back to the teachings with the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama started speaking. And he said, no violence, no violence. He said this several times. And then he said, you must have compassion for the Chinese. Yes, you must step up for Tibet. Yes, you must work to make Tibet free, but no violence. And I began to cry because all I could see is this angry, aggressive mind that I had. And here you had this holy being telling people not to be violent. If you're not aware of the situation with Tibet, the Chinese invaded Tibet in 1950, took over the country and have occupied it ever since. You hear about the Chinese going in and trying to destroy the Muslim cultures there in the western part of China, but they have been doing this with Tibet since 1950. There are points when the Tibetans weren't even allowed to study Tibetan in school. So for the Dalai Lama to say this is quite amazing, and this is because of his strong belief in karma. The whole idea of if you are going and you're violent with the Chinese, then the violence will come back and that kind of thing. And there are a lot of beliefs about that. Actually, if you're not familiar with the Dalai Lama, he used to be the head of the Tibetan government in exile, but he has since turned that duties over to someone else. But he is the leader of the Buddhist religion in Tibet, if not through the world. He's kind of like the Pope is to Christians. The Dalai Lama is to Buddhists. There are many different kinds of Buddhist sects, but I think it's rare that you would find a Buddhist that didn't revere the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama actually says that his religion is kindness. And that's because he understands the power of kindness, because what happens when you're kind to people is it not only helps them, but it feels good. I love this about Oregon. There's kindness built into the laws. If somebody comes to a crosswalk, you must stop and let them cross. And people are so used to doing that, they'll stop in the middle of the street when somebody's crossing in the middle of the street. And that's a small kindness, but it's powerful. When I was in China, I was in a small village and I was sitting on a bicycle waiting for someone to come. And a Chinese woman came walking by, and her small little older woman, and her face was all crunched up like she was really angry and unhappy. And I looked at her and I said, Ni Ha, which is hi in Chinese. And she looked at me and she went, oh, came over and patted me and went, Ni Ha, Ni Ha, Ni Ha, was patting me, when her demeanor totally changed and she became very bright and happy. I don't know why she was so happy that I spoke to her and said hello, but I always thought since that time how wonderful it would be to be able to simply create this happiness in others just by saying hello. So we will be talking about this too in our segments, the whole power of kindness. But what I started to tell you about was when I would come back into this culture and I would see this anger and I would see this prejudice, I had been in a monastery running a clinic for the monks and the nuns and all the Westerners that would come to visit, this was an international teaching center. And I wasn't used to the anger. So when I would come back, it would be almost like startling to my system. You know, I was out of the country for a year and a half, and I'd come back to all this anger, and I almost felt like I could feel it. Not everyone, but often I would go in and I would work as a nurse on some kind of psychiatric facility, and often I would meet people who would be aggressive towards me, and it was like they would just keep coming. And I would just be kind and patient. But what I realized after a period of time was there seemed to be something within the culture of mistaking kindness for weakness. On October 25th, 2019, Barack Obama gave a eulogy at Elijah Cummings' funeral. If you Google the eulogy like I did, you will find on YouTube that part of what he said is this.
It's been remarked that Elijah was a kind man. I tell my daughters, and I have to say, listening to Elijah's daughters speak, that got me choked up. I'm sure those of you who have sons feel the same way, but there's something about daughters and their father. And I was thinking I'd want my daughters to know how much I love them, but I'd also want them to know that being a strong man includes being kind. That there's nothing weak about kindness and compassion. There's nothing weak about looking out for others. There's nothing weak about being honorable. You're not a sucker to have integrity and to treat others with respect. The Honorable Elijah E. Cummings.
So I agree with Barack Obama. What he's saying is that kindness is not a weakness. And this whole aggression of coming at somebody who's being kind and patient is a sort of faulty software program that some people have. The example is some of what President Trump says in his speeches when he talks about not being weak and the liberals are weak because they care about other people, and all the different negative things that he says, and the false presentation that he has of what kindness is. And he actually acts like anger and aggression is strength, whereas in reality, anger and aggression is weakness. Anybody can be angry and aggressive, but it takes a lot more energy to be kind and patient. So in this show, I hope that people will email me at mllauri@kbu.org and give me feedback. Ask questions, give me feedback on what you're hearing, and I will include these emails, what people are saying in the show, and this way you can join in part of the conversation. So when I'm talking about kindness, I'm talking about you can immediately increase your happiness by doing a kindness towards someone, as I showed with just saying hello to the old Chinese woman. It doesn't have to be anything huge or big, but it's also very important, especially as we discuss these different kind of things, that we learn to be kind to ourselves, in particular us Americans. One of the things that I actually heard from several different people from Europe and one Australian about this whole idea of Americans being so insecure. And I would come back into the country and I would pay attention and see what this was about. This is mostly particular to America because it's part of the American culture. But this is where I am at the time. So this is why we're talking about this. If something applies to everyone, I'll tell you. But specific to American culture is this whole idea of you can never be enough. You can never be smart enough. You can never be accomplished enough. You can never be thin enough. You can never be attractive enough. There's never enough. And so it creates this whole insecurity because we are never enough. So we will get more and more into these conversations as the episodes go on. And I hope that you will join me in the conversation. And I hope, mostly I hope, that you will learn to be kind to yourself. I'm Imal Lori, so I hope you stop for a minute and think about all of this. And join me for another episode.